Hey there, Smashers, and welcome back. Don't forget, you can stream episodes of Smash for free on NBC.com through September 17th, so get on it.
Podcast!
Hi, this is Ruth.
And this is Tina.
And welcome to Talkin' Smash,
the podcast where we wear scarves and talk about Smash. Today we're going to be talking about episode 2, The Callback. It aired February 12th, 2012, and NBC's synopsis of it is, the final decision is revealed after Ivy and Karen are brought back for a second callback. It was written by Teresa Rebick and directed by Michael Mayer, which is just as it was in the pilot episode.
Yeah, so let's jump in. Yeah. So we left our two heroines both going into their, well, that was supposed to be their callback, mm-hmm. but we're having more callbacks.
Yes.
And we open with another Karen fantasy number, just like we did in the pilot. Mm-hmm. And that was fun. May I just say, I think Karen is probably a terrible waitress.
She probably is. She's yes. distracted, and she's probably more than a terrible waitress, a terrible coworker, because it sounds like her Asian coworker has to pick up all of Karen's slack because she has to remind Karen to wait her tables, and then she covers Karen's tables while Karen's distracted. And I imagine working with Karen is not fun.
But Karen is just so gosh darn nice that her Asian coworker was happy to do it.
Yes, because yes.
Because yes. Karen is so darn nice, and
that's what token minority characters are for, to serve the white heroine.
Yeah, and then we move to Eileen's office where the four.
Well, I just want to say though that Karen's opening song is Blondie's "Call Me," because she wants a callback and because she's edgy.
Oh yes,
and I like her shirt. It's like a cutout button-down shirt.
I know.
But I think it's actually a necklace. I think it's like a, I think somebody, because at first I thought it was a shirt and then I watched it again. And I think that it's kind of like a necklace or even a pseudo scarf, although I did not count it as a scarf because I think it's like somebody cut out the buttons and the collar of a button-down shirt and she's wearing it like a bolero tie.
Yes. Okay. So you don't think it's actually connected to the shirt itself?
I don't, because when I looked at the back, it doesn't.
I liked her shirt a lot as well, but I also thought it was a very impractical thing to wear as a waitress.
Mm-hmm.
Because how is it staying up? Spills, etc. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Unless you're like a Playboy bunny, I don't really know a lot of waitstaff who have a lot of chest skin on display. Because
it's funny, when I was reading reviews of this episode, somebody noted that and wondered if they were trying to compete with the Playboy Club, which was on at the same time, roughly.
That's a show I forgot ever existed.
You know, I remember it because it was on at the same time because there's a joke about it at the Tonys. Once all these shows are canceled, there's a song about how all these shows are canceled and they all star
was
in musical
the,
theater stars.
Oh, was that the one with Laura Benanti? And yes.
It was also at the same time, because I always confuse it with Pan Am, the Christina Ricci show, mm-hmm. which starred Margot Robbie.
I did not know that.
And I always confuse the two, and I think Margot Robbie was the one in the Playboy Club.
So, as we know, chronology is not my strong point,
yeah.
because I thought Glee may have come on later than Smash, and yeah. Glee started
and
three or four.
Definitely on at this point.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, Glee, I looked it up. Glee started in 2009, so mm-hmm. 3-4 years before Smash. But those other shows, I wonder if those were like a network response to Mad Men, I'm assuming.
I think they were.
Yes.
They were.
Okay.
That I remember.
Yeah. And it just goes to show, if you're a network, you can't do what a cable network can do in terms of edgy content. We love the word edgy. It's our favorite word. Okay.
Okay, but yes, Eileen's office.
Yes, where the big four are having a debate about casting. And we have our first scarf of the episode.
We do.
It's a Tom scarf, not a Julia scarf.
Oh, a surprise from Tom there.
Yes.
And so Tom is really pushing hard for Ivy.
Oh, this is one of the other lines that I noted. She has to have chops. Yeah. So, I think chops is a great music word to get in there.
It is.
So, But yeah, and I like, you know, so they're all debating who can we have, mm-hmm. and Derek is
Team Karen.
Yeah, Derek is Team Karen, but he's such a consummate professional that he's like, he understands that he can't give this to a rank amateur, mm-hmm. and well, he says neophyte, and I enjoy how he says it. Mm-hmm. So they decide to have yet more mm-hmm. auditions.
And we also learn that Ivy has 10 years of Broadway experience. So she's like really, really been working the chorus line mm-hmm. for a long time. I wonder if she's had any featured roles where she'd appear on, you know, the top of the program at all, or if she's just really been
I would imagine that baby. Like maybe in Broadway she's only done chorus, but she's done other stuff.
Maybe she's done a tour here and there.
And I also imagine that she started very young. Like I could imagine her like getting her first show at 16 mm-hmm. and dropping out of high school and just doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they at this point we don't know a lot about Ivy's background except for a very vague phone call to her mom.
Her mom is not supportive and much more excited about her brother who's going back to school and seems like a complete wastrel.
Yes.
And is not excited for Ivy and her mm-hmm. marathon audition.
And we get a scene of Ellis eavesdropping.
I love it. Yes. Ellis, you know, Ellis for the win. Yes, and we get to meet Eileen's assistant who gives Ellis a little shade for eavesdropping, mm-hmm. at least at this point in time. But
they're
and
like,
then we move on
like
to
the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of Smash.
They oh yes, yes. Well, Ellis is also like the plot accelerant of Smash, mm-hmm. which I guess in a way Rosencrantz and Guildenstern sort of are. Okay. We'll go with that. Yeah. But then we move to Ivy and her chorus buddies, and they're having the same discussion that Karen is having with her coworker of like, I can't believe, and you've been waiting so long, etc. Oh, and I love her girl chorus buddy, who is, I believe her name is Jessica in the show, says, you know, where they're talking about Ivy is telling them about the other person that's in the running, mm-hmm. and they're like, Karen somebody, and I love how her friend says 10 years in the chorus and then Karen somebody shows up and it's so true.
That's really true.
Yeah. And it made me think of Every Little Step.
I wanted to make sure that you had seen that.
Oh yes. We've talked about it. Yes.
We've probably watched it in the same room because I've watched that documentary a lot. And Every Little Step, for those of you who haven't seen it, is wonderful. And it is a documentary about the casting of the revival of A Chorus Line on Broadway. And it's fantastic. And I have watched it about a dozen times.
I've watched it, I think, at least twice. But one of the things I remember from it is there is an Ivy.
Yes.
And she's got like 10 years experience. She's been in a ton of shows. Mm-hmm. And then there is a Karen.
And then a girl just shows up on the bus from Jersey.
Yes.
And
the thing
she's just got that something.
Yeah. Well, no, because it's the experienced one. She's had so many close calls and she knows like all of the potential heartbreak that is coming her way. Mm-hmm. And you can feel it like that. She just kind of psychs herself out in the final audition. And whereas the girl who just kind of stumbled off the bus from Jersey, mm-hmm. Goes in and is just thrilled to be there and is thrilled to have gotten this far and doesn't have any of angst about it because mm-hmm. she hasn't had her heart broken for 10 years.
She's not jaded yet.
Yes. And of course she's the one who gets
it's a heartbreaking moment in the documentary.
Yes. And, you know, and you can't hate her because
she's good.
She is good. She's talented. She's sweet. She's lovable. And, you know, she bangs into the boom mic that the documentary guy is holding. And she's like, oh my God, I'm sorry. And it's delightful. And so we've got a very similar dynamic here between Ivy and Karen. Except I don't like Karen quite as much as, you know. But that's okay.
You know who does like her more? Karen is Dev.
Yes. I like Karen more this episode than the last episode. Oh my God, Dev. So I want to like Dev. No, but I don't. I enjoy hearing him say words, though. Mm-hmm. I enjoy hearing him saying the word electronically.
Yes, I think Dev is even, I think he's more charming in this episode and more problematic in this episode.
Yes,
so in
he
both
is.
Directions, he's very sexy doing his job.
Yes,
like the he one of his duties as an assistant to in the mayor's office is to speak with the press, and he's charming and he's quippy, and he knows everybody's names, and he's like I was a little swoony.
Yeah, and then other stuff happens.
Mm-hmm. And then they set up a very tropey plot line, which is they establish that Dev has a very important business dinner that Karen needs to come to impress his bosses. And, of course, it's going to be the same day as a rehearsal.
Yeah. Do they talk about that then? Or I think that might be later when they're getting a hot dog.
Is that later?
Yeah. This is where she talks about that she has to go back because they have to see me dance.
And she's nervous about dancing.
Yeah. And
she knows something that's good is that Karen told Dev about having to go to Derek's apartment, because there's a cliche often of, you know, people hiding something like that from a significant other. But then it goes right back into trope because she doesn't tell Dev the crucial information, which is that he sexually harassed her.
Yeah. I don't think she had a choice in telling Dev that she was going to the apartment, because Dev was with her when mm-hmm. she got the phone call. Because mm-hmm. remember, they were having their little...
Their rehearsal session. Yes.
And then she got the phone call and was like, oh, that's the director. I have to leave. So I don't think she had a choice in telling him.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if she would have. If they didn't share an apartment.
Yeah. But yeah, she did the whole because nothing happened thing. And.
Which I think is so gross, because already the show is trying to create a love triangle where what Derek is doing is sexual harassment. This shouldn't be Karen is potentially falling for a coworker. This is a powerful man is sexually harassing her.
I didn't get any sense that there's any Karen falling for Derek vibes in this episode.
I think Dev is jealous.
Dev is jealous, yes.
And some of that might be for professional reasons that Derek is, which is silly because they're in completely different industries. And Derek is just older. So, of course, Derek is more established in his career. Dev is a child still, basically, mm-hmm. like Karen.
A sexy
British child of Indian or Pakistani descent. Mm-hmm. And I think, though, that the show is creating a love triangle, because Dev expresses jealousy over Derek's power, and Karen makes a point of pointing out that nothing happened at his apartment, which is something you say to, like, a jealous boyfriend.
But honestly, like, probably if I were in Karen's shoes, I would have done the same thing at that point, because in terms of, like, I want this job and I don't want my boyfriend to be upset about me getting this job. Mm-hmm. And because...
Which sucks, because, of course, the conversation should be about sexual harassment and not... Is my boyfriend going to be mad at me because I'm trying to be a woman navigating a world in which sexual harassment happens? And what's real is that this is real, that Karen, I think it's a very real situation that Karen would be nervous about telling Dev that her potential future boss hit on her, because it is a real situation where the boyfriend, rather than being concerned, would be jealous or defensive or possessive and see it as, rather than being worried about her safety or worried about what this is going to mean for her in the workplace, it's a threat to him as a man, rather than Karen's not centered in it. It's about Dev's feelings and not Karen's feelings. We don't even know how Karen feels about this. It's right now right now, Karen has to manage Dev's feelings about Derek more than we even get a chance to know. Is Karen okay? Like, does she feel like she has a grip on the situation with Derek? And it's just upsetting because this is 2012 and we haven't been having these conversations yet. And this is a thing that's frustrating to watch because the show is already going in a direction that makes me squidgy.
Yeah. Well, I think we're supposed to feel that Karen kind of Karen kind of has the upper hand now because she did her whole, you know, happy birthday, Mr. President thing, mm-hmm. and then, you know, told him it's not going to happen mm-hmm. and left on like a high note, which I think that was probably the most socially irresponsible thing the show has done so far in terms of if someone's, you know, someone's has lured you to their apartment, what you should do is, you know, taunt them with your sexuality and then leave and nothing bad will happen. But, Yeah, so I think
I'm nodding. On one hand, it's, wow, Karen really found a way to finesse that situation and she handled it like a boss and all that. And on, but that's the sort of thing that gets women really, really hurt in real life.
Yeah. So, but I think in the world of the show, like Karen's just fine because she took the power back, etc. But, oh, and then we have Karen's dance call with the dance folks. And
I think you might be jumping over
Frank
and Julia.
I did jump over that.
And
yes.
We cannot miss that scene.
Yes.
They're not in the kitchen. This is Frank and Julia at the adoption agency. And they're meeting with their adoption rep. Mm-hmm. And
could we call her the adoption doula? I don't know if she even appears after this, but
the adoption doula. Yeah. Sure. Because I have no experience with adoption. I have friends who are trying to do it, but they're at the very, very beginning. And I don't know any of this.
I'm sure it's not a real word, but I like the thought
doula.
Of it. Adoption doula.
Sure. And they're also not wealthy, you know, Manhattan famous people too. So I don't know if they even have an adoption doula. Mm. But Frank and Julia have been married for 18 years. They're 10 months into the adoption process, and their adoption doula tells them that they're looking at least 2 years more before they would have a child. And we learn that they are trying to adopt a baby Chinese girl.
Yes. And no scarf on Julia.
No scarf.
And but I believe a chunky necklace.
Chunky necklace.
Yes.
And I was trying to figure out if there was symbolism, if she was vulnerable in this moment.
Yeah. Oh,
but
yes.
Now we're at Karen's dance room.
I know. Yes. The adoption plot line is so memorable that I can...
Yes.
Forgot. Yeah. I had no notes on that scene. But yeah, so then we go to Karen's dance call, and this is fun. I enjoy that... Ivy's friend, Chorus Boy Dennis.
Yes.
And
I love Chorus Boy Dennis.
Yes. He's one of my... Yes. We get to know lots of chorus boys and chorus girls, but yeah, Dennis mm-hmm. is amongst my favorite.
And Karen's so polite. Like which it's good. You should be. You should be polite to the little people. Like she comes in, she introduces herself. She shakes hands. She greets everybody who's like in the room with her, which is nice. It's like she's got manners. She's got home training. It's mm-hmm. it's a nice thing to see.
Yeah. And I like we see the dance captain, who I've learned is the actual choreographer of the show.
Ah.
Joshua Bergos.
Cool.
And I like the chorus boy Dennis gives him like just a little bit of an ogle when he's doing the dance moves, which mm-hmm. I fully support because, you know, he deserves a little bit of an ogle.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And... that was fun.
And this is another moment where I think the show is trying to tell us that Karen is becoming attracted to Derek, because there's this moment where he's like positioning her body and the camera lingers on like her looking at him.
I know, but like because of what happened in the pilot, like every time he touches her, I'm just like, ew, gross.
Oh, I agree. That is my reaction. But I'm also looking at what the show is trying to tell us.
Yeah.
And I
think the show's trying to tell us Derek likes touching her.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get a sense that she was into it. I felt she was a little uncomfortable with it too. But he's definitely playing like hot and cold with her.
Oh.
Mostly cold at this point in terms of, you're late and your arms are weird.
I find him abusive.
Yes.
He's a terrible, terrible human being.
But, you know, very apt as a theater director. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that all theater directors are abusive, but mm-hmm. I think he's certainly...
Yes,
he's certainly believable.
He absolutely reminds me of directors I've worked with.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, I haven't had, a director pull that mm-hmm. particular, like, apartment at 10 o'clock move. But yes, the hot, cold, mm-hmm. you know, you're my special person and doors shutting in your face. Yes. that all sounds familiar.
Yes. And then we get to the opening credits.
Oh, wow. So many things have happened.
Yeah.
And I love that Dennis spies for Ivy.
Oh, yes. I love that.
Every mistake Karen makes.
Well, I love that because, you know, he's a good friend to Ivy, but he doesn't like really dog on Karen either. He's very like matter of fact. He's not like, oh, she's a cunt and I hate her.
Yes. But you know, it took her 3 times to learn the combination.
Yeah. But he doesn't like, he's happy that I think he doesn't like overtly rejoice in it. He's just like, hey, mm-hmm. good news for you.
Yeah.
The other girl.
It's factual.
Yes. And I like that they didn't make him like super like.
He's not bitchy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Super bitchy. Yeah. But, and I like the little opening credits thing that, you know, it's the sound of the orchestra tuning up. And it's one of those things in reality, like you don't hear that if you go to a Broadway show because mm-hmm. they've already done it. Mm-hmm. But even though it's.
It's nice. It's like the beginning of Chicago, where you hear the orchestra tuning up and then the 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yes. So, yeah, I like
it's
that.
Nice.
And we have
nice
the lights touch. Come up. Yeah. And then, oh, and then we get to Julia and Tom working.
Yes.
And I love this. Yeah. So there's a corkboard and I like watching them work. I think Julia and Tom have a lot more spark and energy.
I love their chemistry. I like this scene. I think that the show could spend a lot more time with scenes like this because I think there's inherent conflict where you have two creative people who are trying to put a show together.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's natural conflict that would come out of two close collaborators figuring this out. Like, you know, are we telling a linear story or a non-linear story? Are we telling
this should be the opening number. This should be the closing number.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good scene and it goes into the mechanics a little bit of how do you make a show?
Yeah.
And I also do like Julia's line that it takes longer to adopt a baby than to write West Side Story.
Mm-hmm. Because musical theater is her frame of reference for
yes.
everything. But I think like she has so much more chemistry with Tom
she
than
does.
She has with her husband. And I have a theory that I developed watching mm-hmm. this episode that they are sandbagging Frank.
The husband?
Yes. Because I feel... Yeah, because Brian D'Arcy James could certainly be... winning
but
and sparky and
yeah,
have banter with her.
He's a name on Broadway. I mean, he might not be a name to...
But, and also, yes, he... We,
the television audiences, but...
From other performances, we know he has the ability to be fun and charming mm-hmm. and sexy, and he does not do any of those things here.
No.
And I think that's the show, yeah, sandbagging him a little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah. But, you know, so I love this working session with Tom and Julia, and then Ellis ruins it, and that's fun, too. That's fun, too.
He's such a third wheel. And he's such a third wheel.
Such
a villain. He's a delicious villain because he's so frustrating, too. And you hate him, but since Ivy really doesn't function as an antagonist, if Karen's supposed to be the protagonist,
mm-hmm.
Ivy really doesn't function as an antagonist because Ivy's too endearing.
Mm-hmm.
We want Ivy
We're
to
rooting
do
well. For her. Yeah.
And Ellis is the closest thing we have to a villain.
Well, I don't know if he's a villain yet. Right now, he's an annoyance.
Mm-hmm.
But, and to do the All About Eve comparison, So in this scene, in their overall relationships, Julia is totally the Thelma Ritter, mm-hmm. and Tom is the Bette Davis, and Ellis is the Eve Harrington. Because Tom, like, when Julia and Ellis are going back and forth, he's just kind of sitting there in the middle, sort of enjoying and being entertained by Julia's obvious irritation with mm-hmm. Ellis. And then, of course, Ellis leaves the room and immediately eavesdrops again.
Yes.
And I know, I love that we've established him right away as, we've established him as a sneak. He's mm-hmm. a sneaky little fellow.
And he thinks that he's claiming the show was his idea. He says, it's just so great hearing my idea come alive. And I mean, Julia loses it at that. Mm-hmm. That makes her completely irate that he would claim credit for something that they are spending every waking hour working on when he just, you know, mentioned her name basically.
Yeah.
But I also found it, relatable in retrospect. At the time, I found it super annoying, but passing of time and a little wisdom, I definitely remember being in my 20s and being low on the food chain. You know, at the place where I worked, and wanting to be one of the people making decisions, and feeling like I wasn't getting credit for things I suggested or things I did, and not realizing really that how much the people above me were actually doing, but mm-hmm. just feeling like I deserved more than I was getting.
Yeah. Well, I know it is fun. And I think I've experienced a little bit of that in my, you know, current profession too, where what I look back at some of the stuff I was doing 5 years ago and like how seriously I took it mm-hmm. and like the importance I gave to it. And now where I'm doing other things and I was like, I took that way too seriously when mm-hmm. I was doing it. It was not that big a deal, you know, but he's young.
Ellis is also very unclear on his position. he really sees himself as an assistant in terms of Tom and Julia's work, as opposed to just Tom's personal assistant in Tom's day-to-day life.
That is a good, yes, yes. I would agree with that. He his role as assistant is to pick up the dry cleaning. He is not their dramaturg or, yes,
he's not
assisting.
An assistant at Tom and Julia Inc.
Yes, yeah. So
he's the house sitter who picks up the dry cleaning.
Don't tell Ellis that, though.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't have to. He's probably eavesdropping on us right now.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then we get back to Karen and Ivy. And
more dancing.
Yes, more dancing. And I think, well, this is another thing. If you are not someone who can enjoy hearing the same song over and over again, this is not a show for you, because I think this is a challenge that, like, any show about mm-hmm. a musical or any show about musicians has in terms of if it's going to be at all have any sort of verisimilitude, you're going to have to hear the same song over and over again mm-hmm. as they rehearse it, you know, or as they're doing it in different performances and different situations, etc. So I think they had, you know, this is the first episode where we see them have to start to deal with that challenge of how do we show multiple scenes of a rehearsal for the same song and have it be interesting. I think they do a really good job of it this episode.
I think so too.
Because, well, we'll get to that at the end. But yeah, in terms of we just see little snippets here and there, and then at the end we see it all put together. And because we haven't seen the whole thing over and over again, it's still fun.
Mm-hmm.
So, but also I think we probably both have a high tolerance for watching something we like over and over again.
Yes.
So we made up. Yeah. But no, I thought they did a good job of that. Another scarf.
And this scarf is actually alluded to because Derek brings Ivy in to meet Karen because he's trying to fuck with Karen. And Ivy compliments Karen's scarf. And Karen says, thanks, my mom got it for me for my birthday. And Ivy goes, oh, that's cute.
I know, that was such a great passive-aggressive cute. And isn't Derek such a little sadistic mastermind to like bring her in, bring Ivy into the room to do this mind fuck? But it's, you know, it's an effective move. Mm-hmm. But, and this is where I start to gain some respect for Karen. She recognizes it for what it is, because then she and Dev have their hot dog scene, mm-hmm. and where she calls him on it and is like, he's a psychopath. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this scene is the scene actually where I have the biggest problem with Dev.
Oh, yes.
Because Karen is complaining about Derek and how he's abusive and psychologically abusive. And at this point, Dev still doesn't know that he sexually harassed Karen. But Karen's complaining, and Dev says that Karen is creating her own suffering by not getting used to Derek's attitude. And it's so,
I got so irate. I wrote down, get used to it, Dev? Really? Get used to it? Ugh, Dev is part of the problem.
He is part of the problem.
Ugh, because on the one hand, he would be really angry he at Derek if he knew what Derek did, but at the same time, he's like, get used to it, honey. It's the way of the world.
Exactly. And Karen is trying to be communicative here. You know, mm-hmm. she's letting him know about her day and everything and what's on her mind. And, men are trash. Dev's reaction was terrible. It was so bad. It was so bad.
Yes. Yeah, and yes, this is when he tells her. I think this is when he tells her about the dinner. And as soon as he mentions it, like, you know, she's not going to that dinner. Yeah. Something's going to happen. But, yeah. Oh, boo, Dev, boo. So.
And then we get the little backstage clip at, I keep wanting to call it Heaven Can Wait, but it's Heaven on Earth.
Heaven on Earth.
The show that Ivy is currently in. And she's practicing her Marilyn. And it's like, it's very charming to watch her doing the Marilyn in her
yes,
mirror.
And she does it very well.
She does.
And this is in contrast to Karen, who we haven't seen do anything or like do any sort of homework on her own. Mm-hmm. She's just...
She watched a movie and tried to accentuate her breasts. And that was the extent
Which, I mean,
of
she
it.
Did successfully. They mm-hmm. were accentuated.
Yes.
But yeah, we haven't seen her do this kind of like hardcore work that Ivy is doing. Mm-hmm. But I guess she's too busy going to all those dance rehearsals. So
that's true.
Yeah.
And then we're back to Julia and Frank.
Oh, Julia and Frank.
With the adoption plot line.
I will say Frank is an excellent vegetable chopper. And yes. He had chopped so many vegetables.
I was wondering what he was going to make with all those vegetables.
I don't know.
Perhaps a stir fry? Because... There were, you know, because he was chopping all these vegetables and he was just putting them all together in a bowl. So you might think salad, but then there were things like, there was broccoli and raw broccoli would not just go into a salad. But then there were things like radishes, which wouldn't go into a stir fry. So I'm not sure what
you know
dish
what? He could have been doing pre-chopping vegetables for the whole week's worth of meals.
He could have been meal planning.
Yes, there we go. But yeah, he's an excellent chopper.
He was. And this is a nice piece of business for Frank to be doing.
Yes.
You know, nurturing the household.
Yes. Because role reversal, he's the homemaker and she's the one that works.
And I didn't get the sense at all in the pilot that he was a stay-at-home parent. Because he just, one, their son is just old enough that I guess I wouldn't think that he would be.
Because he's 30?
Because he's 32. I'm willing to compromise that he looks 28.
Okay. but yeah, so...
But Frank he didn't read a stay-at-home parent. Maybe just the wardrobe that they give him. He's very business casual. Like,
that's true. I guess I was sort of projecting in the pilot because I knew what happened later. But yeah, I can't recall anything in the pilot that they said that... specified that he was a stay-at-home parent.
Yeah, they talk
all
about
we knew
it in this it, yeah, it's just
all we
this
knew
episode.
Was that he didn't want her to start on a new show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so and Leo interrupts their discussion about
Julia, this is before we get to Leo's entrance, Julia tells Frank that their adoption doula has an adoption group for them. They're now going to adoption support group that's run by their adoption doula, and they need to write a letter to the birth mother And this is just like an exercise. It's not probably a letter that the birth mother would ever get. So Julia's like, gets out her notebook and she's like, great, let's start. And Frank gives pushback and he's just not sure. He starts doing the math of how old he'll be when their kid, you know, graduates high school. And he's just like, he's not into it anymore. And then
he has his doubts. And then Leo enters. And it's funny, like every time Leo enters, like, you know, I just, you know, I want it to say on the screen, Leo, a high school student. And I think him entering, and especially when he enters this time too, and he's full of teen angst, it just made me think of Soap Dish, mm-hmm. you know, in the very beginning where Kevin Kline's character is doing Death of a Salesman in the, in the Florida dinner theater. And he's basically the same age as the two actors who are playing Biff and Hap. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Leo makes me think of, just in terms of, you know, age inappropriate casting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Casting is very important. I think that Leo was miscast.
Yes.
And Leo is very, very, very upset that they might not adopt this baby. He wants a vote. He's always wanted a little sibling. They promised him. He believes his sister is waiting for them. And that part's actually sweet. That, like, he...
Well, here's the thing. He thinks
that his sister's a little... There's, like, a little unwanted baby, and she's waiting. And if they don't adopt her, who will? Like, she'll just be waiting.
The next American couple on the list.
But I thought that one thing about, like, picturing... Maybe because of the news right now, and, like... You're seeing, like, we're seeing, well, like, the kids. You know, kids who are trying to come to America, and they're being ripped from their parents' arms. And, you know, there's just, maybe it's just images like that and mm-hmm. that are getting to me. But I actually found that one, not the whole thing, but that one line from Leo, just a little sweet about just wondering about the poor unwanted child.
Yeah. This whole, like, the whole scene of Leo and Julia, like, out on the deck when he's saying all this, like, it just, like, it hit such a false note for me. Yeah. Because here's the thing. The dialogue in that scene is for a child of 10.
Yes.
Not for an 18-year-old who's actually 30.
Mm-hmm.
Every word he was saying, like, I could picture a 10-year-old child saying it. I could not picture an 18-year-old high school senior or junior, whatever he is, who's grown up in Manhattan or Brooklyn, mm-hmm. saying these words of, like, and also, because also if you're an 18, if you get a baby sister at this point, like, you're never going to live in the same house, yeah. like, house with her anyway. So it is kind of like,
how does this affect you? You're almost grown up. You're at the end of childhood. You know, you're about to go enter, you know, your college. You're about to go have your college experience. Like, you're.
I always dreamed of having a little sister when I was a freshman in college.
Grow up with a sibling. Yes. Is past.
Yeah. I know. Yes. Yeah. He's not going to grow up with a sibling at this point, no matter what mm-hmm. happens. So, yeah. But yeah, so that, like, I feel like that dialogue was for a 10-year-old. That's...
Mm-hmm.
And even if a 10-year-old was saying it, I still would have probably found it a little cloying. But that's just me. So...
Yeah, it's... It doesn't work.
Yeah. What's going to happen to her? All right. I'm cold.
No, you know what? On one hand, I don't know why. I honestly think it's because of what's happening
yeah.
in the news this week.
And that, yeah. yeah. That's very upsetting. I get upset by that. This I don't get upset by. So.
Mm-hmm. But on a happier note, then we go to Tom and Ivy again, and Tom visits Ivy backstage. He just kind of wants to check in with her, and, like, and he says something so, this is really sweet. This is like an earned sweetness. And Tom says, you know, I would have just given you the part.
I love when he says that. Yeah. And I really feel the relationship between them. Mm-hmm. And also, he's kind of the only one who's been fighting for her this whole time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when Tom and Julia are having their working session earlier, mm-hmm. in Julia's imagination,
she imagines Karen.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we know Derek imagines Karen.
Mm-hmm. And then when the four major players are together, Julia and Eileen are both on the fence. They're not.
Yeah.
They're intrigued by Karen as well.
But I do.
It's nice. Tom really believes in Ivy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's lovely.
They're good buddies. I like that.
And now it's the Sardi scene.
Yay! Oh, it's Eileen. Yes, we go to the restaurant. The Eileen and Jerry scene.
Oh, it's so great. Eileen runs into her ex Jerry, and he's with a young blonde, and the blonde is impressed by Eileen, and Eileen destroys her.
Yes, and Eileen is there to meet Derek, and they're talking, and then Derek gets pulled away by a real-life Broadway producer.
Jordan Roth.
Yeah.
To talk about directing a vampire musical.
I love that it's just loud enough for us to overhear him saying, it's a vampire musical. And
that's so great.
Yes. Because you imagine nice how touch. Many like vampire musicals were in development at that point? I'm sure it was more than one. And I do love they also throw out the breadcrumb that this workshop that they're planning to do is going to cost around $200,000.
I love the business details.
Yes.
I really like that. I like that. I only watched the first season of Empire, but I like some of the stuff about, you know, the contracts and the business and, you know, I find it interesting. It's what makes it a workplace drama.
Yeah. And then while Derek is talking to Jordan Roth, Jerry comes over to Eileen and is saying, what are you doing?
And Jerry also doesn't think Marilyn would be a good musical. So what is it with husbands or ex-husbands not thinking Marilyn would make a good musical? I don't understand. I think Jerry and Eileen is such an obvious choice.
Yes. But yes, and I think Jerry and Eileen have more chemistry than Julia and Frank.
Oh,
because also great. I think Jerry never would have divorced Eileen. I think he loved his life of having Eileen as his wife and also getting to sleep around with young actresses. And I think that was his ideal scenario. Mm-hmm. And Eileen was not into it anymore.
Mm-hmm. And they absolutely have chemistry in terms of like actors who just like they spark together. Like it's just electric when they're together. But I do find Jerry also abusive because he's putting Eileen down. He's psyching her out, saying, you're not a good businesswoman. I'm the businessman. I'm the one who knows how to make the deals. You're just an idealist. You're just a romantic. You just like the idea of theater. I'm the one who actually can get a show made.
Yeah.
And that's not a marriage. That's not somebody who's like trying to stay married to this woman.
Well, no. I agree. That's not what you want in your spouse. That's very bad spouse behavior. But I think it's coming from a place of like he really wants to punish her because she left. And and then she throws a drink.
Manhattan in his face.
Yes. And it's the best drink throw because she doesn't look at him when he's doing this whole diatribe to her. And she doesn't look. She just throws the drink in his face. And it lands perfectly in his face without her looking. And it's great.
And that's what you get when you pay for Angelica Houston.
Ugh. Yeah. And also, this occurs to, you know, I think it occurred to me later, but I'm fascinated with her bangs too, and how often she must have to cut them. You know, because you could to have like a full straight bang like that. Mm-hmm. That requires maintenance. Like she has to be getting that cut at least weekly to keep it even, maybe even more so. But it's worth it.
Probably. I mean,
but yeah, it is a high maintenance haircut.
She probably goes to Anna Wintour's bang trimmer.
I would love it if they shared a bang trimmer. Yeah. Yes. But I imagine they do. Yeah.
And we get a little bit more of Eileen and Derek's work relationship, which sort of complements how we see Julia and Tom working together. We see how a director and producer work together on sort of like the business end of it. And Eileen is talking with Derek about how is this going to go? Like, are we going to do the whole, are we going to spend 3 years making this musical? And Eileen really wants to throw the current formula out of the box. And she wants to fast track the show. She says that all the shows she's seeing right now are overworked. And she really wants to get this show workshop. She wants to do an out-of-town tryout, and she wants to get it on Broadway. She, you know, she doesn't want to spend years and years and years, you know, polishing it.
Yeah. And yeah, I think, and Derek's relationship with Eileen is very different than his relationship to actresses. She is a peer mm-hmm. as opposed to them.
Yeah. He almost like, it's almost.
It's like, probably like how
like
Harvey.
A beloved nephew and aunt. I almost get like, she's definitely like the boss, but he knows that he's favored and he respects her, and there's just something they have a lovely rapport that works. And and of course, even men like Derek, there's some women they respect.
Well, I was going to say, it's like, it's probably how Harvey Weinstein treated Meryl Streep.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yes. Well put.
Yeah. And then we go back to Karen practicing her dancing. So here she is doing a little work outside of the audition room. Mm-hmm. So good for her.
And she's very cute practicing
yes.
in her living room.
Mm-hmm. Doing her little Fosse-esque little arm thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we go back to Julia and Frank.
Yeah, Frank wants to go back to work. He is a science teacher, a high school science teacher.
I think yes.
That was his former career. And and what we learn at the end of the scene is he walked in on Julia attempting to write the letter to the birth mom, and she just tossed the notebook aside.
Yeah. But it's funny because he really never outright says, like, I don't want to go through with the adoption.
Yeah.
It's a very wishy-washy thing where he doesn't say adoption is off. He expresses his hesitations mm-hmm. with it. And then the discussion ends because Leo comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And then here, he's just like, I just want to go back to work. Well, I do like what he says where he says, you know, you have the show, mm-hmm. all I have is the waiting. And I think that's a point to Frank. Yes,
absolutely.
Very true.
And to what you were saying earlier, if Leo is indeed, you know, a 17, 18-year-old, if he's an upperclassman in high school and he's about to go to college, I mean, for a stay-at-home parent, that's like...
What's left to do? Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's...
Yeah, but and also...
You can only chop so many vegetables.
He's run out of vegetables to chop. But, and also, like, you can have a job and still go through with an adoption.
Yeah.
I mean,
as I mentioned, I have two friends who are at the very, very early stages of even thinking if they could possibly maybe even be considered to be selected for an adoption, and they both have jobs.
Wait a minute. Both the parents work, and yet they're still pursuing adoption? What?
I know.
Crazy.
Right?
Yeah. But, and as a science person, because, you know,
yes,
my degrees.
Yes, you're the scientist of the two.
Yeah. I enjoyed the dialogue between them, and you know, when he's like, I never could get you to understand P orbitals. And
I didn't know that word.
Oh, well, let me tell you. So electrons, when they circulate around the nucleus mm-hmm. of a molecule, there's different ways that they circulate. So the first orbital is an S orbital, and that is just a sphere. And so that's like what the first two electrons do. Around the nucleus of an atom. And then as you have more electrons, first there's P orbitals, which are kind of shaped like, yeah. Okay. People can wiki this. This is probably not interesting to smash people. But yeah, so there's P orbitals and then D orbitals, I believe. But
I've already started going, meow, 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 meow.
But was it sexy? See, I liked that line.
It was cute. Yeah, it was. Like that line that Julia found him talking about his science stuff sexy. Because that, like, that points to an 18-year marriage.
Yes. Yeah. So I liked that line, but I didn't... She didn't seem to find him sexy right then.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a comfortable rapport.
Mm-hmm. Yes, their marriage, like in the pilot episode, their marriage looks like it's in bad shape. And this episode, it looks like their marriage is okay. they're just, they're having a conflict right now because maybe they want two different things.
Yeah. So Frank is definitely a lot less angry in this episode, mm-hmm. which I appreciate. Angry Frank was not fun.
No.
So yes. So that was part three of the adoption plot line in this episode, I think. And then
Dev at his business dinner, and everyone's excited to meet Karen, and his coworker's wife apparently has heard how attractive Karen is.
And may I just say, the coworker's wife is my MVP of the episode. I thoroughly enjoyed her.
She was really good.
And I liked how she said, Clyde has an eye for the ladies. Yes, I enjoy and how maybe she had had one cocktail too many already, but I enjoy how she's just very sort of blithely telling the truth.
Yes.
And saying truthful things. And her husband is kind of like trying to shush, husband, boyfriend, whatever, is just trying to like shush her down. Like, honey. Mm.
Yeah, it's a nice detail. And she has a line later in the episode too, where she's like, her husband's trying to brag about how he has so much stability because he's married. And the wife, perhaps she's had a second cocktail at this point, is like, it's not like any of you men are ever home.
I know. And he's like, honey, shush. But yes, so I thoroughly enjoyed her. I thought she was great. Yeah. And
of course, as everybody could see coming for miles and miles and miles, Derek keeps Karen, and who at no point ever says, hold on one second. I'm supposed to go to a dinner. Let me just let mm-hmm. them know not to expect me. I mean,
and this is definitely Derek is playing some cat and mouse with Karen mm-hmm. again and playing and power tripping a bit. But
at no point, I will say that even though she's clearly leaving, Derek does have someone. He doesn't see Karen leaving and invents a reason to keep her. He literally has someone there to do scene work with her.
Yes.
So
yes. So again, I feel this is somehow Karen just being dumb. Like mm-hmm.
And Karen does not say, I have somewhere to be.
Yeah. Oh,
I just want to check, are we going to be done by 8, you know?
The Karen of the last episode who put on the shirt and did yeah. the sexy song and then said, see you later, fella. That Karen would have taken the moment to be like, wait a moment. I just have to send a quick text message and then fine.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but he is just throwing the digs at her though, in terms of like, we would have gotten to this earlier, but the dancing took longer than expected because you are terrible. And then when they're doing the scenes again, Karen
has done no homework.
Yes.
I mean, it's fine to ask the director, you know, I think it's fine for her to ask, do you want me to do Marilyn? Do you want like some accent? No, like what are you looking for? What do you want from me? You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you're, but she's done nothing and she's not giving anything and she's not trying anything.
Yeah. And also, again, she's kind of asking these questions after the fact because I guess because she's so green and new, which is fine. But again, like the power dynamic between them is really... it's weird.
This is yet another moment where, because I do love the business stuff, where the thing I'm missing very much is, where is Karen's agent? Because an agent would probably be having a larger role in like setting these things up and communicating between client and prospective.
Yes, because presumably her agent would have told her, first there's going to be a dance part and then you're going to do some scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but yeah, agents do not exist in the world of Smash.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, and the thing I like, the thing about this too is like Derek is, you know, kind of doing his power tripping thing with her, of like, you're giving me nothing, which is...
It's true.
It's just,
I don't
which is
like
true
him,
this
but
case.
It is true.
But then he kind of steps in and starts directing her. And
he gives good direction, I think.
Yes, I agree. He's giving her good direction. And I think maybe what they're establishing here, too, is that Derek is such a consummate professional, I suppose, or that's definitely the wrong word, but that he is such an artiste that he can't stand by and not do his job and not direct, even though he likes toying with her and playing, or even though he's irritated with her, he still can't, that does not stop him from going in and directing and like turning on like his nurture button or when he needs to.
He's such an artistic genius that he can't help doing his job even though he's a jerk.
Yes. Yeah. And then we go back to Dev, who is sitting all alone at the restaurant because he is such a drama queen.
Yes.
That he has staged the scene rather than going back to their apartment or like texting her and being like, dinner is over, I'm going home. Mm-hmm. He waits for her in the restaurant. So he makes her schlep all the way downtown, probably, you know, miles away from where they live and where she was to... just so we can have this scene in a crowded restaurant rather than have it at home. Because Dev is a drama queen.
Yes, he very much is. I mean, Karen was absolutely wrong not to take 30 seconds to
Karen was wrong.
And so I think Dev has a right to be upset here. And it's also super dramatic to wait for her at the restaurant.
Yeah, he is super dramatic.
And he's jealous of Derek. Again, he brings up Derek, you know, oh, you're so... he says something about how powerful Derek is, like that Derek's so powerful, so therefore he's more important than I am.
And oh, that you, like this guy has so much power over you that you couldn't stop for. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also he adds this line about like, I was so worried about you that I couldn't focus all the way through dinner.
Yeah.
Because also me personally, I refuse to worry about people being late in terms of I just do not go down like that path of like, maybe they were in an accident, maybe they're never. I'm just like, they're late. I'm going to focus on other things. Mm-hmm.
And this is why I'm putting on my like, how would I fix this? How would I make this better hat? But if Dev knew what Derek pulled...
Yes,
would he have more reason to be scared for her?
Well, I think if Dev knew what Derek had done, then he would have legitimate reason to be worried. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he has reason to be worried. I think he's saying worried because he was annoyed. Mm-hmm. But...
And, yes. And once again, and I do remember being young and passive and not always communicating well with significant others and rehearsals do go late.
Like, yes. A lot. But also, like, he knew she was at a rehearsal, so...
For a job she didn't even have yet.
Yes.
Like, this is a big deal.
So, like, I think he could have made the mental leap of, like, oh, gosh, I guess that ran over. Mm-hmm.
It's tough. I think this is a classic and very cliched plot line of, you know, we're in our 20s and we're in really important stages of building our careers and... Both of these things are equally important.
Yeah. Well, we have seen this exact scene, this exact goddamn scene in so many movies and TV shows of where the girl is trying to have the career and she has a work commitment and she misses the guy's big event and he's sitting at home alone with like a birthday cake with a candle still lit on it or whatever. And I mean, this scene was in The Devil Wears Prada.
Yes, it was in Damages.
Yeah.
Which I would totally do a podcast about.
That's too many seasons. We have a 2-season maximum.
Okay.
On what
Did
we can podcast
that
about.
Long?
No, Damages went like 5 seasons.
Did it really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess I tapped out of that earlier than I thought I did. Okay.
But yes, so this scene is a classic that should maybe be retired. But yeah. And then, in contrast to Ivy's rehearsal with Derek, I mean, to Karen's rehearsal with Derek, we see Ivy's rehearsal with Derek. And I have a theory about this scene. So, you know, Ivy starts and then she stops herself and she's like, crazy, that word crazy, it's so volatile. And she does this whole little riff and, you know, and her musings on it, and she like drops like all these things she knows about Marilyn and her past, and oh, her mother was crazy and that was her biggest fear. And then she sits back down and she does the monologue again, like brilliantly. Mm-hmm. And so my theory is that like this whole thing is staged on Ivy's part. That
really?
That she does it kind of so-so or meh the first time, and then stops herself being like, I know this is meh, this is not great. And then I'm going to muse about it. And then I'm going to sit back down as if you've given me brilliant direction, and I'm going to do it brilliantly and thus show, yeah.
Wow, I didn't get that at all. I thought
this, my theory,
was showing us just how prepared Ivy is, that she's even not only can she be directed, but she can self-direct as well. So she has a sense of how it's going, and she stops, and when she has a question, and she asks an intelligent, informed question, and she's just prepared. I just get that, like, Ivy's professional and prepared, and she's ready to go. And honestly, it reminded me of some of my favorite moments of doing theater as an actor and having those great conversations with directors when you're working on a monologue and you're thinking something through and you're talking and you're making connections about, oh, maybe this is what, you know, the writer is getting at. Maybe this is what the character is thinking. And, you know, you're having these light bulb moments. And mm-hmm. I really like the scene. It seemed familiar to me, and it made me root for Ivy even more.
Yeah. I do think my theory is that it is definitely showing she's prepared, mm-hmm. and all those things. But I think she is demonstrating her preparation, and that the whole thing is a performance on her part. And then they bone.
Yeah, they do. And it's funny, I remembered this differently. I remembered it being more of a situation like with Karen, where mm-hmm. it's like, I need to, where it's more overtly sexual harassment. But this is, it's so weird because it's strange, and it's because it's not, it's sudden. It's a very sudden jump cut from Derek possibly maybe directing her. And because, you know, Derek, like he first asks permission to touch her. He asks permission to let down,
take
her,
down
hair.
Her hair.
And I mean, directors, it's not unthought of for a director to touch an actor they're working with, like, okay, loosen your shoulders, or like, try this. No, you know. And yes, of course, maybe male directors enjoy doing that with young female performers a little bit more than they should. But off of what you were just saying, you know, I got the sense at first that, like, he's being a good director. He's saying, relax a little, let down your hair, you know, just be her, just be Marilyn, just take a breath. But then it goes to boning instead. And I didn't see any interest from Ivy.
I think talent is an aphrodisiac, mm-hmm. and I think to someone like Ivy, like, I don't think she's sleeping with him to get the part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I definitely didn't.
But I think she's definitely aware of her sexuality, mm-hmm. and, you know, is willing to use that, mm-hmm. to get the part. And I think, you know, basically they had a moment of recognizing each other's talent, and like that's what interests each of them. Mm-hmm. And
I guess I just wondered, like they, because they moved to a second location. I think that's it. Like, if there was a moment and they're just like, I don't know, maybe I would have preferred it then. If this was like a real organic, like, oh my gosh, we're just like artistic people and we're both geniuses and brilliant, and we're just connecting and like we're having a physical moment. Like, but it's just, I guess it's the fact that it just immediately goes into him deep dicking her, like in her own apartment.
So far in this podcast, I've said the word cunt and you've said the phrase deep dicking. So, yeah, that's just an observation. But I think also because he displayed zero interest in her mm-hmm. in the previous episode mm-hmm. where she kind of sidled up to him after the baseball number and was like, oh, thanks. It was so great working with you. And he had like zero interest in her. Mm-hmm. And so I think to Ivy, and I think we've established Ivy's
which
a little...
I did think, by the way, was genuine. I think that this is like, he's a huge director and she's like saying thank you. I mean, I read it as a genuine moment, a genuine thank you. This was like a real honor to be directed by you.
I think it was a genuine thank you, and I think it was also an overture. I think it was both.
Okay.
A bit of an overture, and which he rebuffed. And so I think if he expressed interest in her this time around, for someone powerful who she respects to have rejected her or rebuffed her and then afterwards express interest, I think that would have been like, I think we've established Ivy is a little maybe emotionally damaged and that just would have been like catnip to her and she would have been like, yes, we're doing this.
That's so interesting. I'm not getting that Ivy is trying to, seduce Derek. I think that Ivy, because she's trying to get the role of perhaps the most famous sex symbol of all time, is absolutely playing up her sexuality because she's trying to get this part. But I think perhaps she's trying to seduce everybody because she's trying to be Marilyn, but not seduce in the sense that she's trying to have sex with the director of the show. She's trying to seduce everybody so that they think of her as Marilyn. I've gotten nothing from Ivy that indicates that she thinks that having sex with Derek is like a really, really great idea. Or even that she wants to, just because she wants to, for fun.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see whether this was like a one-time, mm-hmm. spontaneous rehearsal-inspired mm-hmm. sex event, or mm-hmm. whether it's... But, like, I think Ivy is someone who, like, yes, I think talent is an aphrodisiac for her, and she sees Derek as someone who's talented.
Okay.
So
now we're actually at the callback.
Oh, the Ivy Karen head to head.
Yes, finally. And Ivy knows everyone. Karen comes in and she's just like in the hallway by herself. And Ivy comes in and everyone knows her. Everyone's rooting for her. And Julia is the only person who comes over to Karen and is like, you know, wow, this must be kind of hard. You're good luck. I think you're great. You know? Mm-hmm.
Yes. And then we go into our musical number of the episode.
And even though it's a callback, Derek says the song was so good, we staged the whole thing, which is also a nice way of getting the audience to suspend their disbelief that this would be fully staged with like a full chorus.
Yes.
At this point.
Yes. Well, and I think also it's also establishing that Derek is so great at his job mm-hmm. as a director that, again, he was just supposed to do like this little sketch something out, but instead he's just doing the whole full number mm-hmm. because he's so great at his job and he just can't stop himself from mm-hmm. being such a great director mm-hmm. / choreographer.
Sometimes they do both. And so this is, 20th Century Fox Mambo, not 20th Century Foxtrot, which
yes.
makes sense.
Yes.
And I know there's a lyric, I've been listening to the song over and over and again, and there's a lyric that tries to sort of bridge that gap between why there's a dance called the Foxtrot, why isn't this song just called 20th Century Foxtrot? And Marilyn has some lyric about, that she needs to bring something spicier.
Yeah. Well, I think a mambo is a much funner dance number to do than a foxtrot dance number. But
it's right there.
Yes. But yes, they're subverting our expectations with
And it's a great dance number. Like they start off like it's in a rehearsal room, and then at the appropriate climax of the song, they transition into like the full fantasy version where Karen is dressed up fully as Marilyn, and she really looks terrific as Marilyn.
She does. And I think, you know, we can see, I think what they did really well in terms of this number, Karen was working on this number kind of throughout the episode. Mm-hmm. And we see the first dance rehearsal, and we see the second dance rehearsal. And in those, we don't hear the lyrics of the song. We mm-hmm. just kind of like basically see dancing. And then here, so then, and then she works on it at home too, and she's kind of singing to herself. Mm-hmm. But here we see it all pulled together. And so we see parts of it that we never saw in the earlier mm-hmm. rehearsals. But then later on in the number, you can see the part that they rehearsed earlier. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, yay.
It's well done.
And this is the first time also that in the earlier rehearsals, Karen was just dancing or trying to dance. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time I think you see her acting as she's dancing and singing. And the first time she also does a little bit of the Marilyn voice too mm-hmm. on certain words at the end. And she does like the little wink. So it's the first time I really see her as a candidate for Marilyn.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah. And I do love the whole thing when they move from the rehearsal version to the fantasy version. Mm-hmm. But I also love the rehearsal version in terms of, like, it's just them moving around, like, these office chairs and wheels.
I like that so much. It's real life.
Yes, and they have a mop with a bucket on top of it that is supposed to represent, I guess, a lamp or a Klieg light or something. And I love that, you know. Well, we both come from, like, the Joe Hart school of acting too, where it's like props, schmops, make your props out of anything you want, you know, or your imagination. So that was a great number. And I, you know, for me, that's the first time I see Karen as a viable mm-hmm. Marilyn.
I do agree that now I understand why they might be interested in her mm-hmm. for Marilyn. I don't believe that at this point it's that tight a race between Ivy and Karen.
Yeah, I still don't. I don't see it as a tight race. I know they seem to, but yeah. Because then, we go back to Eileen's office mm-hmm. where they're the big four are discussing it again, I guess.
And at this point, Derek thinks Ivy is perfect, but he's like grimacing when he says that. And Eileen asks, too perfect?
Mm-hmm. And we see Julia in a scarf. I think this might be her first scarf of the episode.
It is the first scarf of the episode, but then she stays in this scarf. Yes, for multiple scenes.
We see this scarf again later. So do we count that as one scarf
one
or
scarf.
Two?
I'm okay. counting it as one scarf.
We count that as one scarf. Mm-hmm. All right, yes. And Ellis is eavesdropping mm-hmm. for the third time in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that this time Eileen's assistant, you know, is just letting him do it.
Yeah.
Like, what are they saying? Yeah. And then we go back and forth to Ivy, and have you heard anything yet? Nothing yet. And also, did you see Ivy had a BlackBerry?
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yes, and I think Karen had a BlackBerry too. So, and it just goes to show you, 6 years ago, BlackBerries were still like the de facto of device that someone would have. Because now you're like, BlackBerries, those are ancient.
Yeah. Do you remember when President Obama had to, like, fight to, like...
to get a BlackBerry?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Because
so
I'm an executive. Like, how do I do executive business without an executive phone? Oh, but yes, the waiting.
Oh, the waiting. Oh, and Derek has a scarf.
Yes, he does.
Yes. So, yeah, we've got scarves. Scarves are abounding. Waiting, waiting, waiting's happening. Oh.
And then finally, Tom shows up backstage at Heaven on Earth. And he says, Ivy, I wanted to tell you in person. And Ivy starts to get so upset. And she's getting all worked up. And Tom says, no. You got it. Yay!
That scene gives me drunk in the bathtub face. It's... and It makes me think of a scene from Parks and Rec. It's the season finale of season 4 mm-hmm. of Parks and Rec, where I don't want to spoil Parks and Rec for anyone, but it's a similar situation of,
you know. Just let people know there are spoilers for Parks and Rec about to happen.
Okay. I don't want to spoil Parks and Rec for you, though.
It's okay. I mean, it's in the zeitgeist, and, like, we've had, like, Galentine's days where, like, you've collated, like, specific episodes.
Yes.
Like, the show for me to watch.
All right. So, okay. I'm going to spoil. It's one of my favorite moments. The whole episode, actually, is when it's just chock full of, you know, many of my favorite moments mm-hmm. of Parks and Rec. But season 4, so the whole season has been Leslie campaigning for the city council. And it's just been this, you know, a long uphill slog, and all of her friends have kind of put their lives on hold, and like all they're all doing in their spare time is like helping her campaign. And it's finally election day, and so the election happens, and then it ends up that it's too close to call. So the other guy has won by 26 votes. Oh. But if someone wins by less than 100 votes, it triggers an automatic recount. And so then the automatic recount is happening, and like all these hijinks are going on across the whole episode. And then this whole thing has been going on all season long. And so then finally it's the end of the episode, and Leslie's like, I can't take it anymore. I'm just gonna like whatever. And Rashida Jones, oh my God, I can't believe I can't remember her character name right now. I am a big Parks and Rec fan. This is not
indicative
of my love of Parks and Rec. Anne Perkins. So Leslie's best friend, Anne, comes in and she says, I have the results. And, you know, you go to Leslie's face and it's like Ivy's face where she's just like, I can't take it. And I know I lost. And Anne says to her, it's still 26 votes, but it's 26 votes in your favor. You won. It's over. You won. And it's the thing again about like her best friend getting to be the one to give her like the best news that she's ever had.
Oh my God, I got goosebumps.
See, this is why you should watch Parks and Rec. It's so good.
I when we watch episodes together, I love them.
Yes.
I love the gifts. I love I love the idea of it. Mm-hmm. I have children.
I know. There's a limit to how much television, you know. But
They're getting older, and now I can start watching. Like, probably Parks and Rec is something that we can watch with them around, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Parks and Rec, I think, is actually... Yeah, you probably can watch it. Well, for the most part, you probably mm-hmm. can. Yeah.
And it's got that guy from Jurassic World and
yes.
the Marvel movies in it.
So. Yes, exactly. And also, I think it's a great show to show children because it models adult romantic relationships very well. It gives you lots of great instances of like healthy, respectful, mm-hmm. you know, fun relationships. So yeah. And also it celebrates female friendship, and Leslie No beats a lot of candy. So it's a great show for everyone. But we're doing a podcast about Smash. Right?
That's,
okay.
That's
but,
correct.
Oh, so yes, Tom telling Ivy, it makes me very happy.
Yes. And then that's contrasted with Derek wanting to also have, like, a special conversation with Eileen. And this I find weird because I find it, like, emotionally manipulative. He's like, I need to talk to you. I need to tell you something. And I don't want you to find out from anyone else. And it's like, Jerry picked up the option on My Fair Lady, and which could have been, I mean, that part was fine. Like, I could understand him wanting to be like, listen, I want to be the one to tell you. But this is what I find emotionally manipulative. But he's like, and he wants me back as director. And, you know, I've put in a lot of work. But then he just goes on to tell her, but, you know, I told him to stuff it. I'm going to work on Marilyn. And I just, like, I think that was emotionally manipulative.
Yeah,
I think he
could
have just been like, you know, Jerry, I want you to know, I want to be the one to tell you, Jerry picked up the option. I'm sorry. I know that's got to be painful and annoying for you. I just want you to know that I'm on your side. I want to work on Marilyn. I'm excited to do this project with you.
You know, you're right. That was emotionally manipulative of Derek. He is quite an emotional manipulator, isn't he?
He's a bad person.
Yeah. But yeah, that kind of flew by me at the time. But you're right. That was manipulative. Because mm-hmm. all he had to say, what he could have said is like, hey, you know, you're going to hear this. Jerry picked up the option on My Fair Lady. Don't worry. I'm not going to do it. I'm 100% committed to this. But instead, he had to do this whole thing of like, Jerry wants me, but I've chosen to go with you instead. Mm-hmm. And then he does that easier on the eyes comment too, which...
Yeah. And again, this is, I think that this could be the director's choice. I think that the show is telling us that we're supposed to find this charming and that we're supposed to think, oh, isn't Derek a good guy? He's loyal to Eileen.
Yes, I agree. I think we are supposed to find this charming, mm-hmm. but we're not quite doing that, are mm-hmm. we?
No.
So, yeah. Oh, and then we go back to we cut back and forth. We go back to the adoption storyline.
Because the climax of the show isn't finding out who's going to play Marilyn. It's got to be what's happening with the adoption storyline.
But what's happening with the adoption, Tina? Oh, my goodness.
So Julia is at adoption group, and she's there alone and without Frank, and everybody else there is there with their spouses. And Julia starts reading her letter to the fictional birth mother, and... It's a real interesting moment because it is a heavy-handed letter, and it is.
There are
phrases in it that are almost red flags for somebody approaching a transracial adoption. But the reaction of the group is, "My God, this is terrific."
I would equate this letter with Karen's original audition in the first episode mm-hmm. in terms of where the reactions of the other actors really has to be the thing to try to sell us that what we just saw was amazing.
Yes.
And
yes, once again, the show is telling us that something is amazing instead of it being amazing.
Yeah. And when she says some line about maybe you'll hear this on the wind.
Yes, and at night we will speak your name on the wind and perhaps you will hear it and know that she is safe.
Yes. And all I can think of every time she says that is the Pocahontas musical.
Yes, Color of the Wind.
Yes. Paint with all the colors of the wind, which is... a musical that I have never even seen, mm-hmm. but I know...
Yes, it's a problematic Disney movie.
Yeah, but, so I'm glad you're with me on team. We don't find this moving, because, yes.
But Frank walks in on Julia reading this letter, and now he's like, now I want to adopt a baby again.
I'm so surprised that Frank showed up at the last moment.
Yeah, the show is not trying to break ground on plot.
Yeah. Because, well, this is definitely a very tropey trope in
yes.
terms of the person, yeah. Because, I mean, in every sort of like high school, in every movie or anything that is about like a high school performing arts kind of situation, mm-hmm. like Sister Act 2 or what have you, there's always a thing of the parent who is not into this and is like, I don't want you to participate in this, and mm-hmm. the kid who participates in it anyway. And then at the big show, they're not there, and then they creep into the back of the auditorium towards the end of the performance at the big show, and the kid sees their parent there kind of nodding along and being like, yes, you were right. This was a good thing to do.
Unless it's Dead Poets Society.
Oh, yes.
And then there's suicide.
But you see, that's what happened when your parent doesn't sneak into the back of the mm-hmm. auditorium. So I feel like this is a variation on that trope of someone showing up at the yep. last minute to give their support.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, and then we have, so my favorite MVP of the episode is still the lady from Dev's Dinner. But also all the people who had lines in all the people from the adoption circle who had lines, you know, gave me lots of chuckles too, in a good way, when the one lady is like, she wrote the best one. And then the guy who's like, I wish I wrote that one. I love that guy.
He's like, great.
Yeah. That guy should get an Emmy. But that was a great line.
We need to identify who those great under fives were.
Yes.
Keep an eye out for them.
Yes. But those were the two, for me, those were the two under fives of note for the episode. And they were delightful. And meanwhile.
Do you want to explain that term?
Oh, yes. So an under five is when you have a job on an episode of a show and you have under five lines. So it designates how much you get paid. Because, like, let's see, there's under five, and then there's co-star, and then there's guest star. Mm-hmm. I think those are the three main ones until you get to series regular. So, well, there's probably recurring, too, but that's kind of guest star-ish. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. So, yeah, that was biz talk.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, but meanwhile, while this is, you know, while we're going through the adoption scene, we're also hearing Ivy sing.
And this is a nice, it comes full circle, because at the beginning, Karen is pretending she's at like a cabaret singing and performing for people who adore her. And at the end, Ivy is actually doing that. Mm-hmm. And she gets pulled up on stage because people want to celebrate her. Mm-hmm. And she's got friends who are performing, and they ask her to do a song, and they shout her out for getting this big role. And
yes, and this song, this is where I'm going to lose credibility for like any musical theater person, mm-hmm, who's listening to this. This song, and I did it this time, and then I recalled doing it when the show first aired as, uh-huh, well, being like, I love this song. And it was definitely giving me bathtub face in terms of, because the content of the song and like Ivy's experience were just married together so well. And I thought she was doing such a great performance of singing it. Mm-hmm. And like when they would show her like looking out at Tom at the audience. But yeah, so the whole thing, bathtub face. And I was like, you know what? I really like this song. I wonder what show it's from. And it's not from any show.
No, it's a Carrie Underwood song.
Yes. So that's where I lose credibility with any musical theater person.
Okay. No, or music person. It's a good song because it's not a storytelling song, but it's a song that you could imagine being in a show, because you can sort of picture the scene that's happening.
And I think that is something that country music and musical theater have in common, mm-hmm, in terms of they're probably two of the only genres that really have story and narrative, mm-hmm, in songs anymore.
I love women's country western music. I don't like most of them, and I don't like really any current male country western artists or the songs they sing, because they're you know, the girl in the pickup truck for the most part, and, mm-hmm, then vaguely racist songs that are just using patriotism as a front. But I love Martina McBride, Carrie Underwood, and Loretta Lynn is my favorite. Mm-hmm. And they have these great songs, and they're full of drama and they're full of story. And I love it.
Yes. Yay.
And I think Ivy sounds terrific. And it's so funny because it's like Catherine McPhee, of course, is an American Idol runner-up. Carrie Underwood, American Idol winner. But this is NBC, not Fox.
I didn't make that connection until now. Yeah. So
I used to really be into American Idol. I mean, I remember the first season you were, because I remember you and our friend Lisa came over to my apartment to watch the season finale,
yes,
of the first season of American Idol. And like, I made like a big deal out of it.
Yes, yes. And I watched the first season, was very into it, and then never watched it again.
I held out for several more years. And I was definitely invested in Catherine McPhee's season. That was the, that guy, Soul Patrol.
The guy with the salt and pepper.
Like he was a prematurely
Taylor something.
Yes. Who was good. I mean, I thought he was a good singer, but I really thought Catherine McPhee would be the American Idol. But that's fine. She has gone on to have like a fantastic career, and that's fine.
And she is going to be making her Broadway debut.
Yes! Yes, I think it's happened officially because I started following her on Twitter, and mm-hmm. It's possible it was a rehearsal or something, but it seems like it's begun.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
So what is she doing? Waitress?
Waitress.
Or?
Oh, yes.
Awesome. That makes sense.
And that, which is a movie that we love, that we saw together.
Yes. Did we bring pie to the movie theater?
We did.
Yes, I thought we did.
Yeah. Ruth and I, this is a recurring theme of our friendship, that when we go to movies, we sneak in themed movie snacks. So like pie to Waitress, and we did like fluffy pink cupcakes to Marie Antoinette. And like for Dreamgirls, we snuck in celery and carrots because Beyonce went on like a really strict diet. Because she wanted to be like very, very thin compared to Jennifer Hudson to play up, you know, the difference between Dina and Effie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, yes, we do that.
Yeah.
And like we stuck in like little bottles of alcohol for Sex in the City.
Yes. Which was very appropriate. Yeah. Oh, and also we forgot to mention Ivy is wearing a scarf in this scene.
Yes.
So
she is.
That's important. But yeah. So I would say this episode... yes, I'm still Team Smash at mm-hmm. this point.
Oh, yeah. No, this is still a show that I like.
Yes. And I also liked that, you know, at the end of the second episode, we finally have the audition process over. And now we can move on.
Yes,
to...
and I remember being surprised because I thought that they were going to drag out. I thought that a huge part of the first season was going to be the casting of Marilyn.
Yes. So I was also very happy that they resolved that so mm-hmm. early. Because I think I also feared that they would drag it out. But
yeah. So this was an actual moment where the show surprised me in terms of plot, as opposed to everything else, which is very tropey and not suspenseful.
Yeah. So, and tropes are fine. Tropes are great. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot. There's, yeah. So, well, should we talk about Smash Lash?
Yes. So Smash Lash is when we talk about critical reception to the episode. And the Smash Lash for this episode is mostly centered on the adoption storyline. Nobody likes it.
Okay.
And nobody likes it, not in the way that nobody likes Ellis, like, because there's people who don't like Ellis and there's people who like that they don't like Ellis because it's kind of fun to not like Ellis. But nobody likes the adoption storyline. And I found out that this was a Teresa Rebick thing because she was going through an adoption process.
Mm.
And so this is her like ripped from her own life. Like Deborah Messing is her.
May I just say, I also think Deborah Messing is doing a really great job in this role.
Absolutely. She's good. There's good acting in the show.
And I have to say, like, I think when I initially watched the show, I didn't like Ellis, but watching it the second time, I like that I don't like Ellis. I find him enjoyable because
he is growing on me, I have to say.
Yes.
And this is why it's fun sometimes to revisit a show, because mm-hmm. especially when you know where twists and turns happen and things and where characters end up. And I think Ellis is not as cloying as he was. He's like Dobby the house elf, because when I first read Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, I hated Dobby. I just, like, I had trouble rereading the book at first because Dobby just bugged me and I found him annoying. And then, like, Dobby turned out to be, like, the best.
Yes.
And I was, like, kind of cringy about the movie because I'm like, ugh, Dobby, you know? And while Dobby, of course, is a hero, Ellis is growing on me as a villain.
Yeah, I would agree. I like that Dobby analogy. It's kind of like the reverse Sarah Paulson syndrome. Because we know, like, the whole arc of it, we're able to enjoy the beginning of the arc where it may be annoying. We're able to enjoy it more.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I think maybe if the show had been clearer, that this is a villain and that this isn't like, because you know what it is? Because Ellis is the same age as Ivy and Karen, and the show is a little confused about, are we rooting for both Ivy and Karen? Are we supposed to be rooting for Karen and see Ivy as like an obstacle to Karen's success? And I think maybe Ellis kind of gets muddled up in there as well, because he's the same age and he's clearly trying to make a break in showbiz as well, just maybe more on like the production side, not as a performer. So I'm wondering if that's why he got a little muddled, because I don't know if I recognized Ellis as an Eve Harrington character the first time around at this point in the show.
Yeah, yes. But this time around, in a rewatch, like, we just know he's Eve Harrington right off the bat. Some British man said this, I forget which one, but his writing advice was kill your darlings.
Oh, yes. I love that line.
Yes.
And I think the AV Club, that is similar to what they said in their criticism of the callback, is that it's like the writer's room got a hold of this plot line and just couldn't let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now we know that this was really a Teresa Rebick thing that she was pushing, but...
Yeah, and I guess also maybe the lesson is it's difficult to write about something while you're still going through it, probably.
Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, Teresa Rebick is, just to alleviate anyone's concerns, Teresa Rebick is doing just fine. She's going to have one show on Broadway this fall and then another show off-Broadway.
And do we know how her adoption went?
Oh, that I don't know.
Oh, we should find out.
Yeah, and we should find out if she and her husband, if their marriage survived the adoption process, because I feel bad about, now I feel bad about how much we've been dogging on Julia and Frank's marriage. Oh. I mean,
I don't know if I feel bad, because I feel like this episode, we're seeing like the good that's in their marriage.
Well, and also I do feel like that the writers of the show are sandbagging Julie and Frank's marriage.
I wonder if at bedtime Teresa Rebick says something on the wind and it goes home to China.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So we will send this podcast on the wind.
And perhaps she'll see it. Do you remember that one time? Because Teresa Rebick and I have Facebook friends in common. This is... And so one time, I saw her commenting on a friend's post, and I took the bull by the horns, and I said,
no, what did you do?
I said, excuse me, Miss Rebick, I hate to interrupt, but I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that I was pro-scarf. I did not get a response. But also no one unfriended me over that.
So there you go. Neutral response to that. Mm-hmm. But yes, if, Teresa Rebick, if you ever happen to listen to this, we love you. We think you're great.
Yes. Just, and I love the scarves.
I do, truly.
Well, I was completely sincere.
Yeah. Though who knows? Like, I don't know. Who knows if this... I doubt in the stage directions she wrote, every character wears a scarf this episode.
I mean, it's...
I think they... Well, this is an interesting question. New Yorker's like, is Leonard. That her vision or is that purely the costume designer's vision? Like, who do you think it was who was throwing scarves on everybody?
You know what? I am going to do a little research into the costumer.
I did my level of research, which is I looked at IMDb. So
good work.
I can tell you her name is Molly McGinnis.
Okay.
And she seems to have worked on a lot of things, but a lot of, you know, contemporary things. And I was thinking it must be hard as a costume designer if you're not, like, doing a period piece to, like, really put your stamp on it. Because a lot of times you're just a shopper. Because
Yeah, I mean, you can't, not everybody's Patricia Fields where you get to, like.
Or just, Lynn Paolo. Paolo? The one who put all those coats in Kerry Washington.
Oh, yeah. I just realized I didn't know that, the customer scandal. I didn't know her name.
Yeah.
Or their name.
Lynn Paolo, I believe.
Such a good job. Such a good job.
Yes. So, but I will say, the costume designer is really establishing a look for this world, and the look is scarves. And I still, you know, Julia, only one scarf this episode, but, like, her whole look of the chunkiness and the whatnot is great.
And what we do get to see from Julia a lot in this episode is her other wardrobe love, which is dusters.
Yes.
Long sweater jackety things.
Yes.
Which I love. And I also love dusters too.
She does love a duster.
I think Teresa Rubick and I would be really good friends mm-hmm. because I imagine that this is how Teresa Rubick dresses as well. So we probably could share a closet.
Yes. This is how, like, I feel like Tina and Faye and I would be good friends because mm-hmm. at certain points in later seasons of 30 Rock, it really felt like the episodes were just being written for me. Like when they would do a whole housewife.
Yes.
When there'd be a whole house episode that was just a Real Housewives parody mm-hmm. or.
Yeah, I remember that one because I remember us texting or calling each other and being yeah. like, is Tina Fey eavesdropping on yeah. our conversations?
Or when Liz Lemon talks about how it's insane for people to bite into popsicles because, you know, like I cannot bear that. Like it's Simon is doing that. I have to leave the room. I can't. Don't bite into cold things, people. Well, that's just me and my sensitive teeth. But, oh, there's a great Smash reference in 30 Rock.
Oh, was there?
Yes. I feel like I'm blowing my wad by doing it in this episode. But it's in a 30 Rock episode that was airing during season 2 of Smash. And Jack or someone is talking, you know, is telling, I think it's when Liz is with her final boyfriend of the show, mm-hmm. but like they're having troubles and he's like, you're a woman in your 40s and you know, you're not ugly and you're not crazy. So that means like you're a commitment phobe and whatever. And, so her response to this of being called, like being told that like she's a quitter, or that like she doesn't follow through on things is she says, you know, I follow through on things. I'm still watching Smash.
And, I remember that.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, that was another moment where I was sure that Tina Fey was in my head.
Yes, yeah. So.
Did we smash it?
I think we smashed it. So we'll just say our social media things
yeah.
and I think be done.
Yeah, you can follow us on Twitter at Talkin' Smash. Remember, there's no G in the talkin'. And our website is talkinsmash.com.
Again, no G.
Mm-hmm. You can follow me at nicewhitelady, underscores after nice and white.
And you can follow me at yellowfairy19, underscore between yellow and fairy. Good smash to you. Give me a kiss.